You're listening to episode one of the Racquetball Show podcast. In this episode,
we'll be talking about racquetball in the Olympics,
the importance of point of impact on the ball, or how to make every shot a setup,
an informative and hilarious discussion with pro player and referee Charlie Pratt,
and we will take some questions from our listener mailbag.
Stay tuned.
Serving 10, must win by 2 points.
It is absolute pandemonium here.
I will be the greatest player to ever play the game.
Anybody who won't die for it
shouldn't be playing.
Get that ball. Get the ball.
Welcome to the Racquetball Show podcast. Welcome to the Racquetball Show podcast. I'm Dylan Reed. My intention with starting this podcast is that I really enjoy having racquetball conversations. I'm always super interested in having hallway discussions with people about every aspect of the sport. Its players, strategy, mechanics, recent events, history, you name it. So I figured, why not have these discussions publicly? I intend to have super interesting guests from the sport on and provide something for my fellow racquetball junkies to enjoy. Thanks for listening. All right, so now we're going to get into our racquetball news. This is something that we plan on doing every episode.
Yeah, it's our first time doing this, and we wanted to give you just a little bit of context. So if you're in the racquetball community already, if you keep up with the Pro Tours and you know the different organizations, that's great. We will be talking about a lot of that stuff going forward.
Yep, but we want to get into some of the things that we'll be referencing so that for the people who are newer to racquetball and maybe don't know that there are professional tours out there, you'll understand our references going forward.
Yeah, so let's just kind of, these are things that you can look up further. Let's just throw a few things out there. Some of the, let's say the important big ones. The first big thing to bring up is the IRT. That's the International Racquetball Tour. Now, they're the men's professional tour. We'll be talking about guys like Kane Wasilenchuk, who's like the Michael Jordan of our sport.
Many people consider him the greatest of all time. Pretty much everybody actually does. You can find the IRT at irt-tour.com. And it's really, there are two pro tours, the IRT and the WRT, the World Racquetball Tour. Pretty much everyone would consider the IRT the stronger of the two tours in terms of playing ability, but there are two professional tours out there.
Yeah, the WRT is basically based out of South America, and there's a lot of participants that come from that part of the country. You can kind of look at it as a minor league to the IRT, though they're not actually affiliated. They're, in reality, competing organizations. Then on the ladies' side, you have the LPRT, and you can find them at lprtour.com. And we'll reference people like Paola Longoria, who is...
So similar to Kane, Paola is the dominant player in on the ladies' side. It's common for her to go an entire year without losing, an entire season. She's very impressive, and she's basically a celebrity in Mexico, which is awesome to see. She's the most famous racquetball player out there on either gender, and... Mm-hmm. Pretty much anyone in Mexico would recognize the name Paola Longoria.
And then for anyone who's interested in how to be involved in amateur events or what's going on in your area, definitely check out USA Racquetball. Now, they're the organization that they do everything for the amateur side here in the U.S., and you can find them at usaracquetballevents.com. Alternatively, you can go to teamusa.org/USA-racquetball.
Yep, and this is going to be a great resource for anyone who's lower level than a pro. And I should iterate that anyone should look into these events. If you're a player who's always just played at your club, look into the club, look into the tournaments locally. There are state associations all under USA Racquetball, and they put on events.
And
check out the events.
And one
thing
that I don't think people know enough about is that you can just go to these events. You feel like, oh, I don't know if I want to play. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just go. You don't need to sign up. They'll be like, hey, I'm interested in racquetball. They'll let you in for free. Chances are they'll give you some food and beer, and you can watch the matches and see what it's like.
Yeah, racquetball people are excited to have more people wanting to play more racquetball events. We're a sport looking to grow. need that, frankly.
Yeah. So. And speaking of growing, that kind of leads us into the main story of this episode, which is based around the IRF. Now, this is the last organization we're going to reference. It's the International Racquetball Federation. And they just came out with some rather big news. So the IRF announced recently that they're forming a partnership with the Olympic Channel.
Yep, the Olympic Channel is basically an internet TV service. So similar to IRT has a streaming service, WRT and LPRT all have streaming services. The Olympic Channel does all sorts of sports. So they do Olympic sports and they do non-Olympic sports.
That's right. And what does it actually mean that if something's going to be on the Olympic Channel? Well, what it would mean is that, you know, you would go to a website and they'd stream events and they'd also stream stories. So think of something like ESPN, which does, you know,
E60s.
Yeah, they do stories on the players as well as do events. And one of the reasons the channel was formed in the first place is because the Olympic Committee has been realizing that there's a lack in enthusiasm and engagement for a lot of these Olympic sports that only come around once every 4 years.
Yeah, so the CEO, Yanis Exarchos, an overseer of the Olympic Channel, he stated that the service's content would focus primarily on the stories of athletes, saying that we need to take some risks, and it's better to take risks now because we're stronger than we've ever been, in reference to the Olympic Channel and the Olympic Games. The personality of the athletes, their lifestyles, are something that are very, very attractive.
Yeah, no, this is great news for racquetball because, you know, racquetball's at a point, at a crossroads, you could say, right now, whether it's going to consider growth or consider kind of fading into obscurity. Racquetball, as you know, was more popular in the 80s and 90s. And to that point, I think a lot of our younger listeners who don't know a ton about racquetball see racquetball as like this old man's game that, you know, is very slow in this court and you barely move. And I think that that stereotype, the vestige of that is left over from, you know, your dad and your grandpa used to play it, but you didn't, you know?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, all my friends who know that I play racquetball, a lot of them didn't even know that you could play competitive racquetball, and they view racquetball as like a country club sport where it's just old, rich people playing this stuffy, slow, boring sport. Well, really, that's not what it is at all. And so it's great that this Olympic channel is going to be putting out content that will show racquetball for what it really is and what the people like, what the people are like, and what the events are like.
Let me break it down this way. So we talk about these organizations. So how did we get from, you know, an organization to getting on the Olympic Channel and then in the future getting into the Olympic Games? So the IRF has to petition, in which it did, and it petitions the Olympic Organizing Committee. And if they recognize you as a sport, that means you are entered into the pool of possible sports that they can draw upon for new Olympic events.
Yeah, and it's the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, and they have specific guidelines that they like to see in order for a sport to be accepted. So in order for a sport to be accepted, it must be widely practiced by men in at least 75 countries and on 4 continents, and by women in no fewer than 40 countries and 3 continents. So racquetball really, it's based out of 2 continents. I mean, North America and South America are the main continents that play racquetball consistently and put out teams for world events. But other continents and countries do have players.
Yeah, they come to the tournaments. Koreans I saw at the last tournament.
Yep, Japanese players like Hiroshi,
there's
Shimizu.
Some French people play. So it's out there. The possibility for growth is real. It's out there. But let's not, you know, confuse things. So we are now entered into the pool in which they can draw upon. But it's still a big uphill battle.
I'm just glad we're recognized as a sport.
Yeah. No, it makes me feel
we're
good.
We're a sport.
So also the Olympic Charter talks about it also must increase the value and appeal of the Olympic Games while retaining and reflecting its modern traditions. Now, there are numerous other sports, or I guess you could say even games, that just as far as things are right now will never make it in. Mm-hmm. Something like race car driving will never make it in because in this Olympic Charter, there's restrictions on mechanical propulsion.
Yeah, they don't want things that are largely based in mechanical devices. So
your car is most of what is competing in these games.
Robot Wars would be fun, though.
Robot Wars would be awesome, but that'd I don't be cool. see them happening soon, Tim.
Also, purely mind sports like poker or chess right now do not have a path to recognition to actually being an event.
Right. So ESPN can broadcast those things, but the Olympic Committee will not see them as a sport under what their guidelines for sports are as of now.
I think that's actually a good thing for us in the racquetball community because, like, we may not have the numbers quite yet, but the sport itself is you need to be, you know, super athletic, great hand-eye, great strategy, you know.
As far as sports go, I mean, it's one of the most athletically involved sports. You have to be in great shape, and you have to be very skilled at what the sport requires. You have to have great racket skills.
Yeah, we'll definitely continue to bring you more news about this as it unfolds, and, you know, we'll definitely be talking about, I'm sure, the first event they broadcast.
Yep, and going forward, we want to bring you racquetball news as it happens. This is what our first episode's news is, but going forward, we'll be talking about more about the actual racquetball tours themselves, what's happening among the state organizations and everything like that. But I think this concludes our racquetball news segment.
And now it's time for our racquetball instructional segment.
Do you, dear listener, have you ever gotten to the club, started warming up, and hitting some really good shots? You're hitting down the lines really low every single time, and with each successive hit, grow more powerful. Everyone's watching, and they're really impressed. Then the game starts, and it's all skips and chest high cross courts. What if I told you that it's not all nerves or simply in your head, but that it actually has to do with mechanical differences? What about warming up might be different than a game?
Well, Tim, the unique thing about drop-in hits, how everyone hits the ball in their warm-ups, is that they're the only opportunity in which you get to dictate where you strike the ball. Now, any experienced player will tell you, on drop-in hits, you should be moving or shuffling your weight into the ball and striking the ball low at a point roughly across from your front knee. This location is often referred to as the power zone. Generally speaking, it should be directly across from your front knee or a little bit behind it in your stance, and you should strike the ball at about the height of your front knee. But remember, the lower the better.
Striking the ball low allows you to consistently hit the wall lower. And striking the ball lower is a very good thing in racquetball. When you strike the ball high, it forces the trajectory of the shot to come in at a downward angle in order to hit the wall low. This means a few things.
You have much less room for error. When you think about the angle required to take the ball from a high striking position to low on the front wall, it's a very steep angle. So if you miss that angle slightly, it will lead to a skip or it will end up high on the front wall.
Also, even if you get the angle right and do hit it low on the front wall, the ball will bounce up instead of staying low because it came in from so high.
Now, if you have a low striking point and a flat swing, in other words, if you're striking the ball in your power zone, there's much more room for error, and the ball will stay low after hitting the front wall, given its flat trajectory. It will remain low as it bounces down the court.
Now, I know what you're thinking. This is obvious. I know where to hit the ball. Well, there's a reason we wanted to bring up this concept in our first episode, and it's because it's consistently violated, and it's easy to implement in your game today. In other words, following this piece of advice in-game will have a huge bang for your buck. You'll quickly improve without requiring a ton of practice and effort.
What you need to do is be cognizant of times when, in game situations, you're electing to shoot a chest-high shot when you could have easily moved your feet to a position to shoot the ball at knee height, or when you're casually backing up to shoot an overhead when you could have moved your feet more quickly, gotten set behind the ball, and shuffled into a low, hard shot.
This is often what separates players at different levels. One player is hitting the ball low and flat. The other player hits the ball high, swinging down on the ball.
Of course, it's not always up to you. Sometimes your opponent hits a great shot and you have to lunge or dive for it. In game scenarios, you can't always dictate that you'll be shooting the ball from your power zone. But so often, it's not inability, but rather laziness or a lack of awareness that forces us to shoot the ball in a suboptimal position.
Now, we're not asking you to play like Kane, well, at least not yet. Clearly, the best players in the game have insane footwork and conditioning that you can't mimic without the years of work required to reach that level of mastery. But there are things you can do right now to drastically increase the percentage of shots that you strike in your power zone without spending a bunch of time and effort in the gym. So here are the four things to remember.
Number one is strike the ball in your power zone. The height of the ball at impact needs to be low, ideally at about shin height, and also you need to hit the ball when it is somewhere between your legs, ideally at around the front knee, directly across from it. Now this can vary player to player. Most top level players strike the ball a little bit behind their front knee on both the backhand and forehand sides.
Two, be aware. Every shot you take, ask yourself, could I have shot that ball in my power zone at my front knee? If the answer is no, I couldn't have done anything about it, well, that's okay. But if the answer is yes, try to correct this mistake next time. You'll correct the error if you notice it happening over and over again. But if you don't notice it happening, you won't ever improve. It can help to watch yourself on video. It's often hard to identify your mistakes when you're in the heat of battle.
Number three is have active feet. While we could dig deep into the intricacies of footwork here, for time purposes, we'll save that for a later episode. However, it's usually not a lack of knowledge about footwork or whatever that holds us back. It's often a lack of discipline. Take a few extra steps and let the ball drop.
And finally, four. Know the situations where you typically fail to follow this advice. For a beginner, it might be that we just don't let the ball drop on an easy setup. It's a simple fix. Move a few feet in the direction that the ball is dropping and hit it once it's lower. For an A player, it might be moving backwards. That is constantly an issue. They might settle for backpedaling overheads when they could move their feet and have a setup on their front knee. For an open player, it could be that they're failing to take an extra step when returning a drive serve. What's important is this. Know when you're struggling, and then you can address this issue. You can't fix what you don't know is broken.
So be brutally honest with yourself. It can really help to watch yourself on film. Ruthlessly cut down on the number of times per game that you could have moved your feet for a better shot, but didn't. This is what the best players in the world do. Watch Kane, Rocky, or Paola. They have unbelievable skills, footwork, quickness, hand-eye, and power. But there are things that they are doing, and you can do them too, right now. They hit nearly every shot exactly where they want to hit it, and why not you? Turn more and more in-game shots into the equivalent of a drop-in hit. Think about it. If you could turn every shot you hit into a drop and hit, how much better would you be?
Remember, when you drop and hit, you naturally hit in your power zone. So try to set yourself up in the game to hit in that area. No one drops and hits shoulder high. And if you know someone who does, please send us videos and pictures because we'd love to see that. Always ask yourself after each shot, was that a shot I could have hit via a drop and hit? If it wasn't, ask yourself why. Oftentimes, you will encounter that is not a problem with your physical skills, but rather a lack of, like we said, awareness or discipline to when that ball was going to be shin high and within your stance. That is to say, within your power zone.
All right. Now, hopefully this advice helps you guys. Go out, use it, and improve your game. And now, here's our interview with Charlie Pratt.
All right, as promised, we have Charlie Pratt here. Now, for those of you who don't know too much about professional racquetball, he's a professional racquetball player. He was also the ref. Welcome to the podcast, Charlie.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Dylan. Happy to be here, my fellow Oregonians.
Exactly. So you are ranked number 16 in the world right now as the IRT rankings, the International Racquetball Tour, which is one of the governing bodies of professional racquetball. High is number 13. And you're also well-known in the community for being the head referee, all the biggest matches you reffed over the last 6 years, is that right?
Yeah, I started in 2009 as the referee and stopped doing the ref thing 2015, so 6 years. And I was as high as number 8.
Yeah, I was going to point that out. That's in our notes. It says as high as number 8, and Prigo says high as number 13. So we want to be complimentative of Charlie.
He's in the top 20, let's just say.
He's what a very happened? Good player.
What happened with that, yeah?
So U.S. national team member as a junior multiple times, right? Played since 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
This year, you're going to be representing the U.S. at the Pan American Games.
That's right.
San Jose, Costa Rica in April.
The Pan Am Championships in San Jose. My first time on the adult national team, which is great because, like you said, I was on the U.S. junior national team for 5 years. It was amazing.
So when is the last time you were a USA member then from now? How old were you?
2004. Okay. So it's been 13 years since I've been.
They're finally letting you back on the team.
Finally. Age 30. Age 30 now. And, yeah, been trying for a decade to make the team, qualify, and go to an international event, represent USA. Just fallen short many, many years in a row, and this year was selected. So very happy about that.
So, Charlie, how does the selection process work for the U.S. team?
Well, I guess since this is my first time, I'm still pretty new to it. But, you know, there are multiple tournaments throughout the year, singles and doubles championships that anyone can qualify for. So if you were to win or be a finalist in any of those qualifying events, you automatically are, well, you have a spot on the team. It's up to you if you want to be on the team or not. You sign the contract. And in my particular case, I didn't qualify for the team in any of the tournaments. But for this international event in San Jose, they go through the team members, the current team members, and they can deny. They don't have to go if they don't want to. And in my case, a couple people said that
so
they didn't want to go.
So you're telling me that they can... They cannot. They will not be forced on the plane and forced to play if they don't want to.
Exactly. Yes.
USA Racquetball will not come to your home and snatch you up and say you must play.
This is not a serious sport. No. It's all up to you.
So, all right. You know, it's interesting. You're our first guest. You're a professional player. I think a lot of people listening, you know, are just realizing there's a professional scene. One of the things we wanted to ask you is, what is, you know, very broadly, what's life like as a professional racquetball player?
Well, it's a lot of work, and I mean, you're training constantly, and you're traveling constantly, and you're competing for your paycheck, and that's the case in a lot of professional sports, but racquetball is the individual sport where your performance on a day-to-day basis really depends on, you know, what kind of money you're making. So the best way I could describe it is it's tough. It's a grind. It's hard physically and mentally, and especially I would say mentally, just in the fact that you're going in and competing, and you really have to be at that. You got to go in to win every single time, and there's no like relaxed day at the office, so to speak, on the racquetball court. That being said, the other side of it is amazing because you make your own hours and you get to travel all over. For me, it's all over the nation, and a few times a year I get to go international also.
Well, how much harder is it, though, than being an NBA player where you have the team jet waiting for you and the chef cooking your meals and the personal trainers? I mean, this is pretty much, it's all you, right? You make
sure.
All your travel accommodations.
Yeah.
And another point, I mean, you say you're competing for your paycheck. In the NBA, they're competing for a paycheck, but it's $15 million versus $20 million versus $5 million,
right.
Where the racquetball sums of money are a little bit lower.
Yeah, definitely lower. We're dealing in the thousands for now, and not the millions, which is still fine. I you know, it's not really. Of course, we would like to make more money, but it's not for me personally. It's not about the money. I love doing this, and even when I don't make money, I'm still having fun as long as I'm competing and get to be just among one of the best players in the world. I think just. In that in itself is a great experience.
That's phenomenal to hear. So, tournament directors, you do not need to cut Charlie a check if he wins any of your events.
I might not come back, though.
All right. So, one of the things I wanted to ask is you've seen a lot of professional racquetball. You reffed a lot. You have a very clear, expert-level understanding of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you enjoy watching? Who makes, you know... I'm sure there's obvious answers, like maybe like a Kane or a Rocky. But who's someone, if you see their playing, you're like, I want to watch this?
Like, who do I get excited to go see?
Who do you get excited about?
Yeah. That's a good question. So, since I've reffed so many of the top pros, I would have to say that I don't get as excited about seeing them. It's mostly, like, matchups that I get excited for. I really like watching Marco Rojas play. He's the first guy I'm going to mention, maybe not like in any particular order, but you know, he's a younger player. He's up and coming. He's mentally focused. Very, very fun to watch in that sense. You know, not going to get overly frustrated, overly excited. But I like watching Marco. He's from Stockton, California. They have a huge scene out there.
Shout out to the 209.
The 209. That's right. You know, his brother Jose is the number 5 player in the world. Marco is currently 7 or 8, something like that. And, you know, the list goes down. There's a lot of, like, top 20 guys from Stockton. They have a great group there. Anyone, you know, younger, up-and-coming, or maybe somebody that I haven't seen play yet, the exciting matches for me are the early rounds in tournaments where, you know, maybe a seasoned pro is getting, like, a young and hungry guy who doesn't have a ranking but is very good, and you know it's going to be a good match. So you're going to go and watch that, like, a matchup that maybe has never happened before. Or if it's my friend, I really enjoy watching my friends more than anything. Yeah. And then my wife also plays. My wife, obviously, it's like a love-hate watching her because it's stressful. Like, sometimes it's even worse, like, outside of the court. If you go to a tournament with your significant other, you really want them to do well because that determines what kind of mood they're going to be in for the rest of the tournament. I'm sure she's rooting for me for the exact same reason, because she doesn't want me really grumpy the rest of the event, you know.
Yeah, for those who don't know, his wife is a women's professional player, a lady named Ceci Orozco Pratt. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that when one of you wins or loses, the other one is there to kind of take the edge off, comfort a little bit. And if you both lose, that could be tough.
It is. It's definitely happened. Ceci, my wife, recently passed me in the rankings. So in the women's rankings, she's number 15, and I'm 16 now. So that's the first time that's happened. And
has that caused any issues in the relationship?
It's caused a lot of bragging rights issues and, you know, just kind of the, I don't know.
Don't tell me how to swing, that kind of thing. I know what I'm doing, Charlie.
Right. The alpha in the house has changed a little bit. I don't know what happened.
You know, you're at a tournament, you're getting a beer, you're at an amateur event, you're watching, you know, a men's A match, and you see the ref just blow a call, and you're like, typical amateur mistake.
Okay.
What are you thinking? What's common? What's a common mistake?
Well, I don't really know what makes people tick as a referee, to be honest. Like, you see things and you don't really know why they made that call, but a lot of it could be that, you know, they're going by players' reactions. So if you watch other sports, basketball, a ball goes out of bounds, both teams are going to be pointing the direction they want. You know, they want possession of that ball, and you see them do it all the time. Same thing will happen in racquetball. Both players will walk up to the service box like, hey, I won that rally. And then it's up to the ref to make a call. The time that they make a bad call is when they try to make a call that they didn't see. So whether they're blocked out or something, that's usually the biggest mistake I'll see is a referee being sold on a call because of a player's reaction, when really they just need to go with their kind of gut instinct. A lot of times referees will try to make a call when a call doesn't need to happen, or, like, you know, if a ball just doesn't look quite right or something, they'll call a skip even though they didn't see it skip. So that's another, and I know you guys have been through the same thing where, you know, a ref is trying to do a little too much, trying to be a little too much part of the match. Really, you just need to be as little to do with the match as possible and, you know, just get the job done and let what happens on the court determine the score, and not really get involved and make calls that don't need to happen. So I think a lot has to do with how well you can see, too, because it's such a fast game that if you you know, this never happened. I never did this. For the record, but let's say you tried to have a beer or something before you ref, even like one beer would be detrimental to your reffing ability. You know, it just changes everything, changes your vision and
boosts your confidence in your call decisions, though, even if they're wrong.
That's true. Yeah, you know, take a little less heat from the players, you know, because you're just more relaxed and you just don't care. But let's
not a good, you know, not a universal principle.
It's a vision thing. It's the ball is moving 160 miles an hour probably on the average fastest speed you'll see in the professionals is around 160, which is really fast. And you needed to be able to determine if it crossed a certain line or hit the floor first or if the player got it after the first bounce. And that's where your vision, but also your knowledge of the game really comes into play. The other mistake I see is when referees are really just in over their head because their level of play is not to the level that is on the court. So you have a C player reffing an open match. It's bound to turn out bad because the C player is not familiar with the capabilities of the players and, you know, the speed of the ball. And that's where you see people making mistakes, referees making mistakes. But that being said, I've made plenty of bad, terrible calls in my lifetime. I mean, 6 years of reffing, it's going to happen. You can ask any professional ref. They're just it's part of the game, and it's a tough sport to I think that's what makes racquetball so unique too, is it's so, I mean, anything can happen, like call wise, or, you know, whether, who knows if a shot was good or bad, but
and I feel like uniquely racquetball, people get more angry at calls than in any other sport. It's almost applauded when people get mad at calls. People get really into it, whereas basketball or football, you can get flagged, you can get penalized. Racquetball, sure, you can, but it rarely happens.
Yeah, you're right. People definitely get a little more animated when a bad call happens. It's an individual sport, so people can take it very personally. It's you playing another guy, and then another person is stepping in and making a call that you don't agree with. Like, of course, you're in there. Like, you got your blood pumping, and of course you're going to light off every once in a while that something happens, and that's unique about it, yeah. And I guess I don't really know what else to say about that.
I have friends that I invite to racquetball tournaments. They may have played high school basketball or even some guys playing squash. They come in, and they're like, dude, I just saw the worst fight go on court three. And I was like, no, that wasn't a fight. That was like a very tame match, you know? Yeah. And they're like, really? I'm like, racquetball players are just like that. And I almost wear it as a red badge of courage. Like, that is like, I'm almost have a weird sense of pride about the competitiveness, the kind of animal, like, adversarial aspect of racquetball. It's like very interesting to see for amateur players to, like, be so aggressive.
Yeah, there's been I had some friends come to a tournament one time and they saw a mixed doubles match where it was a husband and wife. And this is, I wouldn't recommend playing mixed doubles with your boyfriend, girlfriend, husband or wife. I just think it's kind of a recipe for disaster. But they saw, like, a husband and wife get in a really bad argument, you know, like, ooh, to the point where they, you know, they were worried about, like, their future in as a relationship.
think of the children.
Yeah. If there were any, I don't know. But, yeah, you're right. It's like a little, it's not necessarily a gentleman's game. You know, it's not like a golf or a tennis. You know, you see guys break rackets in tennis, and they still get mad in golf, but it's definitely a little bit more of an aggressive, confined sport. You know,
you're like, throwing your body against walls and floors.
We're basically animals in cages.
Great analogy.
Yeah, I agree with that.
No, racquetball is actually it's a great sport because I mean, you're in there so close with your opponent. It's the court is 20 feet by 40 feet, so imagine basically a large living room size court, smaller than a tennis court and much smaller than a basketball court. And it's two people surrounded by four walls, and you're in there, but, you know, it's not like a wrestling match or it's not football. It's not even really basketball. There's really not too much contact in the game. You're taking all your aggression out on the ball, essentially, and your strategy and your endurance and your strength, that's all going towards the ball, basically. It's kind of a martial arts in its own, where you're not necessarily hurting the other guy or causing damage to the other player. It's like a chess match. You know, you're working your rallies and you're working your strategy mostly. That's where most of your focus and energy goes.
So, Charlie, I want to get a little bit into what you do outside of racquetball. Obviously, racquetball is a big part of your life, but people have to have, for the most part, other than a couple top players, people have to have other jobs, and you definitely have interests outside of the sport. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I guess just I enjoy things like gardening. I mean, simple things like that. Those are not just hobbies of mine, but, you know, I have always been into nutrition and the outdoors and things like gardening.
Fit in well to like the 50-year-old white female like demographic.
Sure.
For things, you know, gardening,
sure. Yeah.
Hiking,
whatever. Like
we like to be kind to our guests.
Yeah, it's good for my heart. You know, it's what the doctor says. You do mellow things outside the racquetball court, but. Outdoors, hiking, you know, grew up in Oregon, so skiing, really, like, anything active, really. Like, I have a hard time sitting around, to be honest. I'm recently married, too, so that's sort of changed a lot. Like, you know, my focus went from me and being single to now it's us and maybe starting a family someday. But, yeah, I play golf, too.
Sessie, he's thinking about starting a family someday, so, you know.
Thinking.
Well,
just as long as we stay away from mixed doubles, I think it might happen.
Yeah, I think you can do it. Just don't play doubles. take us through, just very briefly, you know, you got a big tournament. You got the Pan Am Games coming up. You're going to be training hard for that. What's a full training day, a day that's devoted to racquetball? What does that look like starting from when you wake up? You wake up, you know you got to get some work done today.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Well, it's not as many hours as you might think, at least not for me. Depends on the day or depends on what I need to work on. But let's just, okay, so I have 1 month until the Pan American Championships. So you just, okay, you analyze where you're at. How's your strength? How's your stamina? How are your shots, you know? And right now I'm just going to say I'm seriously right at like an even, like I don't have a whole lot that needs a whole lot of improvement or, you know, anything like that. So starting on an even keel in these first couple of weeks, I'd say 2 weeks, focus a lot more on the gym stuff. Get your workouts, your tough workouts in, and get your stamina up, get your strength up, get your muscles and your body ready to compete and to really like perform and become fatigued. Get them used to that because you don't want to be doing that stuff close to the tournament. So the first week is going to be intense for me in the weight room, and of course I'll be getting on the racquetball court probably four or five days a week to do at least an hour a day of drills or playing games, something like that. And if I feel like my, you know, shot making ability is not there, then I'll spend more time working on that.
Charlie, what on court, what would be one piece of advice that you would give an average intermediate player to improve their game as best as possible?
I would say do drills that involve kind of like a conditioning type of thing, footwork mostly. I mean, movement is huge in this sport, in a lot of sports. But I would do, you know, anything that gets your mobility better. So your footwork and your foot speed, there's ladder you can do. It doesn't necessarily have to involve hitting the ball, because you need to get your feet set in order to hit the right shot. And the importance of getting your feet set is what I would say you should focus on if you're really looking to improve your game, if it's not something you've done before. Definitely get on there and practice your shuffling and just become faster on your feet, basically.
What would be ideas that you would like to see implemented in order to help grow the sport?
Well, I think outdoor racquetball is a huge one because, you know, nowadays, and I'm not sure what exactly has changed in the desire to play racquetball. It was a newer sport. It was coming on strong in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, like you said, and it had its momentum, you know, and then something changed, and I'm not sure what that was, but right now you have to be a member somewhere, and you have to be a member somewhere to come in and play racquetball at an indoor facility. And that's not the case with tennis, for example. or even basketball, or even football or soccer.
Or I mean, baseball.
Anything like that. You just need the equipment, and you need to find yourself a park. If racquetball could get itself in more parks, which involves basically building large cement walls, which you see in California and Florida and other warm climate places, I think that would grow the sport tremendously because it's just not out there. It's not in your face anymore. It's not a mainstream sport. So you almost have to accidentally run into racquetball to get into it. You're not introduced by any kind of public to racquetball. It's not on TV very often, although it is on the tennis channel on Thanksgiving, the U.S. Open. Check it out. It's on Thanksgiving.
Well, if we have a big border wall, we can just put some sidewalls on those things, right?
If that happens, it could be courts. The could be the greatest thing for racquetball and
the worst thing for democracy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But okay.
All joking aside. But no, seriously, I think outdoor racquetball is going to be huge. If we can find a way to get more courts on parks, that would be great, because then all you need is a racket and a ball, and boom, you're playing. You don't need a membership. You don't even need instruction. You just need to go and play. And, so that's one thing. I would say I think behind every good racquetball program is a few people who just love the sport enough to dedicate kind of a part-time job to it, to growing a racquetball program at a club, for example, at a particular athletic club. It's kind of one or two or maybe a handful of people that just get together and they want to grow the program. They introduce new people to it. They introduce juniors to it. That's what a good program is. If we could have more people at their clubs saying, I want to grow this racquetball program, that would help tremendously too.
Absolutely. I think that's a big thing. Whenever you see pockets or areas where there are huge racquetball participation, there's a leader or several that are taking charge and are putting in place infrastructure for making great tournaments and getting players to be better. And that kind of has a network effect where more and more players want to be playing. Mm-hmm. So, Charlie, who do you see as the next number one? Who do you think will dethrone Kane?
It's, like, so hard to tell, but, if you have to make, like, an educated guess.
Yeah, you had right? money on this.
Yeah.
You know. You oh, have man. You and the wife shared bank account on the line. Who are you putting your money on, man? Who is the next number one player after Kane?
Okay, so who's going to be... Okay, I see what you're saying.
Multiple elements, right?
Yeah.
Because you have to figure his age.
Like, well, I mean, you know, when... Like, who's going to be the next... I honestly, I think it would be... You know, this is going to sound funny, but I think it's going to be Rocky. Like, I think the next number one is going to be Rocky. Now, is Rocky going to be, like, the next number one for a while? No.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, just...
You think he'll outlast Kane.
Right. You know, and let's just say, like, Kane, you know... Let's say just Kane retires or something happens, he stops playing, and Rocky continues to play for an extra year, he's going to pass Kane in the rankings. That's what would
Rocky
happen.
Rocky will be playing IRT events until he's 55 years old.
Charlie
too.
All joking aside, yeah, I'd like to think so. But, you know, we've seen other players go well into their 40s, almost to 50, and still compete at this level. It's rare. A couple names would be Ruben Gonzalez and then Cliff Swain as well. Cliff was making the finals.
Cliff's still really good.
He's 50-something, and just he's not a guy that you want to draw. You don't want to have to play him, basically. I mean, everybody's tough out there, but Cliff is still fully capable of beating anyone on tour.
He could be the future number one.
Cliff Swain.
Cliff Swain, come
back.
Back
at it. Oh, man.
Come on, Cliff.
Can you imagine?
The challenge is out there. Cliff Swain.
Cliff Swain's plant-based, too, so I don't know. I'm not trying to go back to that necessarily, but it just sort of happened.
All right, so after okay,
so,
Rocky.
Okay, so aside from Rocky, we'll talk younger players now.
Yeah, who's coming up?
Okay, so I'll say one player that is particularly impressive these days is Rodrigo Montoya.
That kid's so good.
From Mexico. He's, like, 20, and just... He is. He plays on the WRT, which is a World Racquetball Tour, which is a smaller tour than the International Racquetball Tour. It's kind of for just younger, up-and-coming players mm-hmm. to to play this different tour. It's in different places in the world too. You know, it's a little more like South America and Mexico based, and less in the States, although it does have the tournaments in the States. But you see a lot more international. You see a lot more players from Mexico and South America playing the WRT, the World Racquetball Tour. So anyway, on that tour, he has won a few events, and very handily, very dominant, and rarely loses, even in doubles, both. And watching him is, you know, he's ready. He's right there, and he's already a top player. And, you know, at his age, and the fact that I think he's definitely a top 20 player in the world. It's just hard to compare the two tours. It is. But he's definitely in the top 20, and he'll give anyone in the world a game. And at that age, that's impressive. And just in the little things you see, like how good is his serve and how good is his speed and his shot-making ability. He's got it all. There's really not a whole
he
lot
does
of
have it all.
Holes
he
in his
is
game.
So fast.
Yeah. Yeah, and not just the most impressive thing for me is his serve.
Mm-hmm, yes.
It's a serve I've never really seen before. You know where he's going, too. For me, anyway, when I watch him, I know he's going to the backhand when he hits or to the left side when he hits that serve. But it's just so good.
Does he generate that power, you think?
Well, he's a long, lanky guy, but he's a built athlete. He's almost 6 feet, and he's 160, 170 pounds of just
muscle.
I mean, you know, no body fat, and 20-year-old muscles. Like, you know, he's limber.
He's not getting sore.
Right. Or, you know, it just, he's built for speed and power, for sure. And he also has a good head on him. You don't see him get too frustrated or, you know, just he, for his age, he's a mature player. And, impressive. Scary, too, you know, because he's so young.
We watched him play this past weekend at the Seattle WRT tournament, and he was dominant.
Yeah.
Another thing I'll mention, apparently he's 20 years old, he's an aerospace engineering student, so I was impressed by that.
Mm-hmm.
Allegedly.
Prove it. Rodrigo, come on the pod, bring your...
Let's
see that degree, bro.
So I'll talk about a couple other names just to throw them out there would be, Daniel De La Rosa. He's the number 3 player in the world now, and he's 24 years old.
And Rodrigo's also Mexican.
Yes.
As De La Rosa is.
Yeah.
I've not been convinced that there's any Mexican player that's better than Daniel. You know, Alvaro's beaten him in the past, but I got to believe that Daniel is the best player from Mexico right now.
Yeah. Although, you know, if you're going to have I was actually thinking about this today, you know, the Mexican National Championship, does Rodrigo play that? Has he played that in years past? Now, I've only seen him come onto the scene in the past year or so. So I'm not sure how he did a year ago, but that'll be a very interesting tournament between, De La Rosa, Alvaro, Beltran.
Yeah.
Those are the number 3 and 4 players in the world. And then Rodrigo Montoya. You also have, Alejandro Cardona is...
Polo. I mean... There's so many good...
Alex Londa. Yeah, that Nationals is crazy.
There's so many good Mexican players. We're going to do a whole episode, I think, soon, devoted to Mexican racquetball because it is flourishing. I mean, they're in an absolute renaissance down there.
And you know, if you have to put money on anyone, it's hard. That's really a tough choice. You almost have, just for the safe bet, you have to say Daniel just because of where he's at now. But, like, Daniel versus Montoya would be insane. I don't know if they've ever played. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's make it happen.
All right.
And then the last one I'll say is Jose Rojas. He's always been knocking at the door. He's the number 5 player in the world.
I want to see him at number 1.
Yeah.
I don't know it'll ever happen.
He is, of all the players, besides, like Rocky and Kane, he's the most professional, you could say, of all of them. He really takes care of himself physically and takes the game seriously and just never stops the training. You know, he's a hard worker, and I think he has the talent once he puts his whole game together. And not just the talent, but the longevity. You know, I mean, the guy is super flexible, too. I don't know
also
if he can...
Also vegan, right?
Also vegan. I'm not trying to go
is
back
he just
to that.
Going
but
vegan on us?
I'm just... Yeah, any player who's vegan is going to be the next number 1. But he takes Jose is, you know, he's also really big into, like, the yoga and the stretching and stuff. The guy really takes care of himself. He's 26, 27 now, number five. He's won a couple of events now.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Daniel.
Yeah,
so
he's still
it's just,
I mean, Jose's been a veteran on the tour.
A young veteran,
still
we'll
a young
say.
Veteran,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I completely
agree.
Like
LeBron James, how he was a
exactly.
young veteran.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah. Yep.
All right.
And his brother Marco will be in the same place, too. You know, but
Marco
I just,
has really good court style, by the way.
Court style.
Like, he has matching socks with his grips, with his shoelaces. And
yep.
Stuff. Check him out. but, all right, we need to, we're almost running out of time here. But I gotta, we have some silly questions. So, you doubles match.
Mm-hmm.
Theoretical. Any historical figure, alive or dead, who's your doubles partner? Who do you choose to play a game of doubles with?
Like, I mean, not a racquetball player necessarily.
Could be anybody.
Anyone, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's tough. I'm going to have to say Elvis, though, because he was a racquetball player.
Yes.
Great answer.
He was a racquetball player. And so not only would I stand a chance with him, but...
You guys would do good.
I mean, he's Elvis.
Yeah. That would be fun.
Yeah. Maybe a member of the Beatles or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's whoever I would really want to, like, hang out with. I wouldn't really care about the racquetball part. Like, am I looking to win this thing or just play, like, a friendly game?
What's a partner if you're not looking to win.
On the line? Yeah, okay, so Elvis, I heard, was also very competitive. He hated to lose, so that's why I'm going to go with Elvis.
All right, good answer. All right,
thank you.
Last question. You're a professional athlete, and I'm sure you keep up with other professional athletes. If you could be a pro at another sport, what sport would you be?
Probably golf.
Oh.
I play golf. I was always very competitive in that. That's like my second sport besides racquetball. And I just think as far as like, you know, being physically demanding and whatnot, like golf, you can still compete up until you're in your 50s almost at some of these tournaments, and you still see it. There are
in
still
your 80s if you're vegan, I hear.
You keep bringing it back. But yeah, you know, the longevity, you know, you're not like, it's a physical sport, don't get me wrong. Like golf, it seems like, oh yeah, like relaxed and you're out in the nice weather and stuff, but you're taking a lot of swings and you're still keeping yourself in shape just like any other sport. But it's a little bit less physically demanding than like a football, for example, or, you know, something like that. But
that's a hot take.
Yeah. So golf, and then, you know, you're outside and you're in
racquetball
nice weather.
Players are good
and stuff.
Golfers, it seems.
Yeah. Well, we share the same contact point, you could say. The swing is very similar. I mean, you're bringing the racket or golf club back, you're coming through and you're hitting it as hard as you can, basically along in the middle of your stance or near your front foot or something. And it's, you know, kind of baseball type of anything involving hitting something, racquetball players will be good at, golfers will be good at, baseball players will be good at. I've played all sorts of sports all my life, and I think that, you know, baseball, I started with baseball, went into soccer, and, you know, even played football and, you know, golf, and they all kind of tie in. I mean, everything's a cross trainer. And Dylan, I know you played baseball. And Tim, I don't know what you did. And
ping pong, I think.
Ping pong.
My mom was proud of me. Well, Charlie Pratt, we really want to thank you for coming in. And guys, if you don't know, Charlie's a really good player, and he probably hasn't peaked yet. Dylan, what do you think?
I hope that he has peaked because we play him very often. So I'm trying to catch him.
Charlie, if people want to know more about you, they want to follow you. Do you have a Twitter? Do you have an Instagram, Facebook?
You know, I do, but Facebook would probably be the best. Charlie Pratt Racquetball.
That's your athlete's page.
The best way to look me up on Facebook.
Him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably it.
All right, brother. Well, good luck at the Pan Am Games coming up in April. We'll definitely be watching you, and thanks for coming by.
Appreciate it, guys.
Charlie, thanks for coming on.
All right, Dylan, it is time to start our first ever listener mailbag segment. I'm really excited about this because it's when we connect with the everyday folk.
I'm excited, too, so... This first segment will be, we just got questions basically texted and emailed in from our friends. In the future, we want anyone and everyone to be able to send
our warm market today.
Yeah, we want to be able to send in, have people send in questions that they text in or email in. You can email us.
dylan@racquetballshow.com. That's D-Y-L-A-N at racquetballshow.com. An email, anything and everything racquetball related, or even maybe a little bit not racquetball related.
And you can find us on Facebook at The Racquetball Dudes. Send us messages there. Send it to our emails. We'll get to it. We'll look at it. We'll look at all your questions. Pick a couple each time. So let's get straight into it. Our first question is from Cody from Boise, Idaho. He writes, what would you say technically separates the top 10 pros from the rest of the pack?
So I would say it's easy to just look at it and say that top 10 pros are just better at everything. So they're better at footwork. They're better with racket skills. They're better with racket preparation. They're better with the mental game. And just go on down the line and say they're better at everything. But as far as just the bang for your buck, what are the most important things that are putting them way above everybody else? I would say the biggest things to me are sort of footwork and conditioning as kind of a combination and racket skills.
Yeah, I think that's right. I would add that, you know, a good amateur player or a low pro has the ability to make all the shots that Kane and Rocky do. They just cannot make it nearly as often. So I think consistency is huge, you know, that where Kane can hit a perfect shot 8 out of 10 times, the open player may only be hit that 2 out of 10 times. And, you know, that 2 out of 10, 8 out of 10, that's, you know, that's a career. That's the difference between a cult career and racquetball. And so, you know, how do you get more consistent? Well, you practice and you're naturally gifted, hopefully.
And the margins aren't even necessarily that big. I mean, in baseball, what separates a guy who never made it from a major leaguer is the major leaguer hit 300, got 30% of the time got a hit, versus the other guy hit 25% of the time he got a hit, hit 250. So the margins aren't necessarily that huge or noticeable. Kane hits the ball a little bit harder than everybody else, but a lot of that is just like minor differences in racket skills and footwork and conditioning. So the next question comes from Brendan from St. Louis, and he asks, what's the best way to bring up your racquetball accomplishments at a bar in order to pick up chicks?
All right. Well, let me start by saying you probably aren't going to pick up chicks at a bar talking about racquetball. Now, if you're – hopefully Brendan doesn't have a girlfriend or a wife, so the first thing would be, you know, do not bring them with you to the bar. But the second thing would be, unless you say something to the effect of, you know, insinuate that you have $500 million in the bank, or that you, you know, do a clean that you're in charge of like a clean water project in Africa for, you know, a bunch of children, you probably aren't going to say a whole lot that's going to grab a lady's attention. But what I will say in all seriousness is that women or significant others, people who are interested in, want to see your passion. They want to see you do what you love. And oftentimes you get into a racquetball court, you become kind of aggressive. You become a little bit primal, instinctual. You're sweating. You're using your whole body. And I think that can be a definite turn on.
That's great relationship advice from Tim Perigo. So, but we actually both have girlfriends who were non-racquetball involved before we met them. And they've seen us play and they didn't know much about the sport, but just seeing us in that, you know, intense, competitive, sweaty environment, I think is helpful for, you know, their, how attractive you are.
Well, also too, I mean, people, who you may have a crush on or you want them to have a crush on you, you know, saying something that you're into physical fitness is a good thing, you know, realizing that racquetball burns 600 calories an hour, that it's a full body workout, that it's, you know, you need to have mental acuity as well as, you know, physical discipline. I mean, yeah, people are always looking for a good workout, but, you know, it's like you want to meet someone who takes care of themselves.
Yeah, shows some traits there. Now, I would say also, Brandon, you could just say, hey, you should see my backhand overhead 40-foot splat kills.
Oh,
I think
man.
That'll get her going.
That's too easy. That's too easy. Brendan, if you have any luck with any of this stuff, please write us back. We'd love to know.
I'm sure you will.
So the next question is from Charlie Pratt himself, who, before leaving the studio here, left us with a question. He writes, have you ever hit anyone on purpose? Now, I don't know if he was referring to me or you necessarily.
Yeah.
But let's just say the question is, you know, the subject of hitting someone on purpose. We've seen it happen before. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I have, if we're being honest. Usually it's not necessarily a...
We're talking about in the game. In the game of racquetball.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's usually not a, I hate this person, I'm going to hit them. It's usually kind of a, they've been in my way, I haven't been getting hinder calls. I want a penalty, avoidable hinder call. And the referee's not calling it. I don't really have an option other than to hit them and show that that person's been in my way.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, sometimes you get hit, so you want to hit them back because you felt like maybe they could have held up for you. You're a little angry that, you know, they're in your way. But I think it's important to note that this is not, we're not advocating violence. This is not to say that, like, you should go up and punch somebody. Because, you know, it's if you're in a basketball game and you, like, start throwing fists at somebody, that can lead to serious injury. But with racquetball, you know, you're not really, short of being hit with a racket, you're not really going to get any sort of serious injury. Not to say that it's okay, but, you know, hitting someone with a racquetball is like, you know, I don't know, throwing a baseball at them, I guess.
This made me think of another question. Mailbag for me. What's the worst you've ever been hit, Tim?
I'm a bruiser. I'm like a banana. I'm like a banana. So anytime anyone touches me the wrong way, it's like a psychedelic purple and orange cloud on, you know, whatever part of my skin. So I don't really know. Honestly, the worst I've ever been hit with is I played a squash tournament at my racquetball gym. There's squash courts there too. I was playing in a tournament and some guy beamed me in the back of like the fat part of my thigh and the inside of my thigh. And it looked like a supernova. I thought you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson was going to show up and start explaining some stuff to me. So anyways, don't hit people on purpose unless you're like a pro or something. You know, it's not fun. that's all I got to say about that.
Okay, Tim with the safety approach. I feel bad now that I admitted to having hit people.
It's all right. You're honest. You're building credibility with our listenership.
Okay. So the last question we get is from Taylor from Portland, and he asks...
Portland, Oregon, that is.
Why is racquetball so damn loud?
Well, Taylor, great question. I think... So Taylor, I know personally, he's not a racquetball player. He's been to racquetball events. You know, he's one of those... He's a normie. He's a guy off the street who's walked into an event, and I remember him bringing this up to me in the past. He's like, it sounds like you're at a firing range. It sounds like gunshots. I don't know that... Racquetball was designed to have that effect. I don't know if that's a desired thing or just an unintentional consequence.
Yeah, and I've gotten similar questions from people who are just trying to work out on the treadmill next to the court. So, like, why is the sport so ridiculously loud?
I've seen people I'm a club pro at a club here in Portland, and I run a racquetball program, and I hosted Jake Bredenbeck. He came to the club a few months back, and, you know, he's a huge bruising hitter. And he was warming up on the court, practicing his drive serve. And I had other members come up to me and ask me if what's going on, can we keep it down? Because it was like disrupting their workout. But Dylan, I think you got a little bit of research as to, you know, there's Taylor, I think, may have sincerely thought that racket, like the racket itself, had some sort of like onomatopoeia effect where
so
it was like, you know.
Some people think that racquetball comes from the term racket as in to make a racket,
right,
as in to make a lot of noise.
That's wrong.
So we actually looked into, and I'm talking Wikipedia when I say looked into, but we looked into the etymology of the word racket.
We scoured the internet.
That's right.
The depths of the internet to bring you this knowledge.
Wikipedia. So we came on, the origin of the term racket is unclear. According to a popular belief first published by Malcolm Whitman in 1932, the expression comes from the Arabic term rahat al-yad, meaning palm of hand. Modern research, however, reveals this thesis in a highly questionable light. Instead, the term is more likely to be derived from the Flemish word racketsen, which itself derived from Middle French racketure, meaning to strike back.
That's pretty interesting. To strike back. So there's an inherent kind of reactionary thing here. It's something, a ball in this instance, is coming towards you, and you're nearly striking it back, you know?
Yeah, that's the idea. And then the palm of the hand theory, I guess the racket in that case would be viewed as kind of just an extension of your hand, which is an apt analogy, I suppose.
Yeah.
So, you know, Taylor, racquetball's loud because people use light rackets and bang a rubber ball in a enclosed court, and that, I think, is inherently loud.
Do you think that racquetball was always so loud? I mean, with racket technology being what it is today.
I mean, it's had to have gotten louder, just the physics.
Had to have. And
I mean, the ball moves faster now.
People are bigger. Am I wrong about that? Are people bigger today?
Not much bigger.
Well, there's better enhancing drugs, right? To make you hit harder.
Yeah, that's why we hit harder today, the steroids.
So we have better rackets, better steroids.
Better steroids.
Better diet.
For some of us.
For some of us. And yeah, so that's pretty much it. Those three things, Taylor.
I'm going to go mostly just that it's a loud sport,
yeah,
with
okay.
a rubber ball
Fair
in
enough.
An enclosed space that
Fair
gets
enough.
Hit 150 plus mile an hour.
Well, Dylan, I think that's it. We did our first podcast.
I think we did it. We concluded the mailbag section, which is the end of our podcast.
Yeah, well, I hope we're going to get episode 2 coming soon, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Hopefully someone listens to these things, but we're just going to keep doing them.
We're going to just keep talking into the ether.
It's like one of those things. It's like, you know, they send out messages into space, those like microwaves deep into space, and maybe they get heard at some point in time and come back. So anyways, we're out here, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Next step is sending this into space. So if you want to get in touch with us, send in mailbag questions or give us feedback. We'd love to hear it. Send it to us at Dylan@racquetballshow.com. That's DYLAN@racquetballshow.com.
And we have a very special guest next time. I don't want to say who it is, but it's going to be a good one.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.